Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's a goal. Who got the assist? Who got the assist?
Hello, so welcome back to the final one of our non-FPL Sonlin Style Eye podcasts. If you are listening for the first time in quite a while, go back to episode one of WTA in lockdown. If you're interested, start at 18 minutes, 30 seconds into that podcast and just basically catch up. But for those still with us, let's get back into it. We're joined today by a special guest to round off our look at Sonlin Style Eye. And this week, we're excited to welcome Alex McCain, the host of the Roker Report podcast, to help us put a button, I suppose, on our Sonlin Style Eye sojourn. Find him at AM_RokerReport on Twitter. That's rapport is in the French word for being friendly. And obviously the Roker Report, I like what you guys did there, you can find anywhere. Welcome, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad, mate. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, cheers, Alex. Pleasure to have you on the podcast with us this week. We are Who Got the Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGTA_FPL for Tom and the main account at WGTA_Nick for myself. And Stag can be found at FPL Stag. And we're also on Instagram now, WGTA.FPL. So Stag, Anthony, what's on the pod this week?
Evening, lads. Great to be back again and welcome, Alex. So like all the other weeks, we've had a news segment ahead of the Sunderland Should I Die commentary. We're not going to be doing the news segment this week. We're going to get straight to it since we've got Alex here. So I guess what's interesting for us is that Nick, Tom and I were maybe the main target audience of Sunderland Should I Die. We're football supporters, but not Sunderland supporters. So during our watch along, it's clear to us that there were some parts of the story that needed to be told from a different perspective, from somebody who knows the club inside out. And especially given the fact that there won't be a series now to come following this turbulent, corona-riddled second season in League One that Sunderland are going to have. There's so many what happened next questions. So brilliant to have Alex here to answer those. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, definitely. And this week, the format's going to be that we'll break it up into two parts. The first is kind of a series discussion, just to reflect on the series, and as Stag mentioned, kind of have Alex's perspective on it as a fan. And second, it's kind of an epilogue. What happened next? You know, there's lots of key characters, lots of individuals that we're really interested in. We saw the kind of the narrative story arc, I suppose, of these guys and ladies, of course. And it'd be really interesting to see kind of what the development has been since for a lot of these people. But I guess to start off with the series discussion, from the very outset, Alex, what was it like to be involved in that sort of show?
Well, it certainly wasn't something that I or we ever expected to transpire at Sunderland. I mean, I think it's obviously one thing for the club to sort of have this tragic fall in the way it did, but then obviously to have Netflix weighed in saying, if you'd like, we can document all of this for what will turn out to be an exclusive on our site. It was certainly something else, really. I mean, we started the Roker Report podcast 3 years ago now in 2017. And when we did, we were recording over Skype. We all had terrible laptops. And, you know, I had an iPhone 4, which I used to talk through at the time of recording that. So to think that it's sort of gone from there to Connor, our old host, having a sort of like spontaneous impromptu pod with the owner, where we literally just on a whim messaged him saying, would you like to come on the podcast? And all of a sudden, Connor's in his Toyota Ego heading down the road to pick him up from the stadium to bring him to the University of Sunderland studio. It was, you know, it's surreal, really, just the momentum from which we've gone from very much a little project would start on the side with the Roker Report podcast to where we are today. So fast forward to what was then the present day, and it's 2018, and you've got people from Netflix coming into the studios, people like myself, Graham, Tom, speaking to the likes of the owners with the cameras in the peripheral filming our dialogue. It was very strange, and I think we felt a certain obligation to the people of Sunderland that if we're going to be a fan podcast on this documentary, then there is a certain obligation, of course, to represent the fans as best we can through our medium. You know, professionals we may not be, but you've just got to sort of give the best account for yourselves and ask the questions which ultimately may make it to the documentary, and fans, neutrals, whoever will be wanting to hear.
And what did you think about the series in general? Just because I feel like there seemed to be a bit of a narrative that they were trying to drive along each episode. You know, you had obviously the episode regarding the Will Griggs saga, which you guys were involved with. And I think I heard on your podcast that interview, they kind of implied or made a suggestion that it was only after two games that Will Grigg had played, when in fact that was right at the end of the season, where you were sort of grilling Charlie and Stewart over the failings of that transfer. And then we saw Stewart as well sort of half throw Jack Ross under the bus during that interview as well, when in fact we saw the reality was that Jack Ross wasn't necessarily that enamoured and didn't really push for the Will Grigg signing.
No, indeed. As you've said there, Nick, that the fact of the case is that as January sort of commenced, the problem was obviously Maggio was sold, and the remainder of the window, as the days ticked towards the deadline day, the need for a striker obviously became more and more desperate. And yeah, Jack Ross at no point was, you know, really passionate that Will Griggs specifically was the man for the job. I think that was, as you saw in the documentary, that was Donald really pushing for that. And I think at the time, the fans, you know, would have been grateful that the owner was displaying that much ambition and wanted the club to succeed that much. But obviously, as is so often the case as a Sunderland fan, the big marquee signings that we make, you know, so often traditionally don't turn out to be the players we want them to be. But yeah, Donald does throw Ross under the bus. What he's implying about Ross in the build-up to that signing isn't necessarily true at all. In fact, there's something of a dissonance there. And unfortunately, I have to say it as a fan, that has been a bit of a trademark now of Donald and Methven's time at Sunderland. You know, now that the dust has sort of settled and now that we can sort of see things a bit more transparently given the nature of lockdown and given that there isn't much to do really but speculate about the club's future, we can see that a lot of the things that we've been told have indeed not been the case. A lot of times Donald and Methven have said black and the reality has been white. It's a shame, but I think to come back to the very first thing you asked there about, you know, what was it like as a Sunderland fan to experience the documentary? I think what I have to say is that I'm rather jealous of you lads as neutrals, because it must be wonderful to watch. Truly, it must be an absolute blockbuster. But obviously, as a Sunderland fan, it's more like the tragedy of which your nearest and dearest is the tragic hero, the main protagonist. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are parts of season two that are much better watch as a Sunderland fan than season one. I think the first few episodes where we're winning more than we're losing, just by virtue of that, is a decent watch. But then, of course, you have the issue that it goes very sour towards the end, and it's the very same tragic tone that you see through most of season one. So, yeah, If you're not a Sunderland fan, then I'm sure it's a great thing to watch, and I really wish I could be you during the moments when I watch the doc. But no, alas, I am a Sunderland fan, and it's fairly painful.
I think having that emotion running through it certainly would definitely colour the view. I think for us, it is a little dispassionate, and just seeing things as kind of like a dramatic narrative, I suppose, rather than being something that has an impact on real people in a lot of ways. And that's what the fans do in the show, isn't it? They're there to provide that sort of impact to the decisions that are being made at Black Cat House, isn't it?
Yes.
Gavin Craig on their pods points out something really interesting, I thought, which is that dissenting fans weren't heard early on in terms of Stuart and Charlie, and they only came in kind of later on. When Stuart and Charlie took over, were they kind of universally welcomed? It looked like from the show that everyone was really happy that the American had gone, and you know, you've got these guys in obviously from Eastleigh, and were there some sections of the fans that were still a bit kind of cynical or sceptical?
Early doors, and when I say early doors, I mean the first days, weeks of Donald's takeover. I would say, yeah, they were universally welcomed, and that's mainly because Donald's promises initially, is the very first things he really said to the fans was, "I want to reconnect the clubs to the club to the fans." And in spite of, you know, all of the detractions that we may have now as a fan base, he did that very, very well. The fans' main concerns under Short, well, I say under Ellis Short, really, if you look back at Sunderland to Ledi season one, it was with Ellis Short at a very far removed distance, and really it was under Martin Bain who, you know, as he made no attempt to sort of compromise, he was sort of the at the forefront of everything at Sunderland during the 17-18 season. You know, he's always sort of sat there on those episodes displaying his watch, sort of talking about how he's up against all odds. And Donald vowed to remove the very toxic business model that you hear Methven speak about in season two. He wanted to take all of the old washed out pink seats and replace them with fresh red ones. He wanted the fans to play a main part in removing the seats and replacing them with new ones, which indeed was an initiative that was very successful. And he promised that we would get a manager and we would get players that would want to represent Sunderland, and he entirely delivered on that promise. So yeah, they were accepted early doors. I think as well, I'd like to think perhaps Emma, without maybe stroking our own egos too much, that Roker Report itself did play a role in sort of promoting the image that Donald wanted to perpetuate. And I think by getting him on that podcast, it was a really big statement. I mean, it would have been unthinkable for Ellis Short to appear on a podcast or Martin Bain, but for Donald to come on the podcast and speak so openly and transparently, it was a really good thing for the fans to hear. And given how removed they'd been from the owner and the hierarchy under Short and Bain, they just felt that they had their club back. You know, it was a feeling that the fans needed, and for what it's worth, they were welcomed with open arms early doors because they made all the right noises.
So I want to bring us back to the way that the fans are portrayed, because that's something that you guys focused on quite heavily in your podcast, and that we didn't really consider the fans' view all that much as we watched. I think it was something we kind of in our WhatsApp group were saying, whoa, the focus on the fans in your podcast was much bigger. And I think you guys felt that it was quite reflective of the fan base. And I think season two was much nicer to the Sunderland fans than season one. And I guess that's part of the fact that the season wasn't just despairing, gut-wrenching from start to finish, in the sense that, you know, the championship season was. But at the same time, also, you know, we got to see Sunderland fans going down to London. We got to see them having their fun there. And then we also did get to see how they reacted in adversity this time, which the documentary certainly portrayed much more kindly than they had with Chris Coleman and stuff at the end of season one.
I mean, look, having a back-to-back relegation is probably going to bring out the worst in a lot of fans with the ire and the frustration. I mean, I think probably as football fans, we all show that in different ways. Me personally, it came out as just complete despondency. Like, I mean, I've been a season ticket holder for a decade now. I'd go to a match, I'd sit there in complete silence, watch us throw another game and then go home. And it was just awful. And a lot of people around me weren't quite as quiet. A lot of them were very vocal and very aggressive. And I don't think it's the image that Sunderland fans would want of their own people. Absolutely not. Unfortunately, you know, the brute fact is that if you subject the fans to that much mediocrity for such an extended period of time, then they are going to sort of feel that effect and display them quite visually. Obviously, season two, it did display them quite well. And despite how much negativity that they were facing, your people like your taxi driver, Peter Farah, you know, to name but just one example, obviously, I think he showed himself to be a great ambassador for the club. Salt of the earth bloke who, you know, obviously bled red and white, cared about his club, wanted it to succeed. And obviously he's joined by a lot of the returning cast, a lot of fresh faces as well in the mix there. And I do think that the documentary displayed the Sunderland fans, you know, in a very true way. I don't think anything was dressed up. I don't think anything was sensationalised. I think, you know, dialogue between fans, monologues from fans were recorded, and they were recorded the first time without any sort of like touches or any scripts. It was very real.
Cool. I mean, I think it's definitely true that there was a lot more focus on kind of the wider cast of characters this season. And one thing that was notable, and you guys noticed as well, was that the players, the access to the players seemed to be really, really diluted compared to season one. Gavin Craig said there was no editorial control for the club as well. So, I mean, why did the players step back from the documentary? Was it just because, you know, Jack Ross seemed to say to, I think it was Craig, that it's a little bit awkward to have the cameras always on him and that sort of thing? Or was it just because of, you know, what happened with Darren Gibson and things like that? The players were too worried to maybe expose themselves.
Probably the latter, I'd say, Tom. Yeah, I would go with the latter. I think Jack Ross does obviously make you know, several appearances on Sunderland Till I Die, but he doesn't make nearly as many as, say, Charlie Methven do or Martin Bain did in season one. And I think that's mainly because they don't really want the notoriety. And I think perhaps if they'll be wary that if things do blow up, then their sort of like visual animated responses will be displayed on Netflix for all time, you know, forever archived online. And that would, I imagine, be something that's quite off-putting to a lot of players. The players that you do hear from are the ones that I think generally I would count on to be the most like politically convenient, you know, ambassadors for the club. You know, you look at Luke O'Nine, for example, obviously someone who needs no introduction if you want someone who's just a very, very nice, well-rounded person.
But maybe George Honeyman kind of provided that position in the first series, and then he was barely ever seen on camera in the whole second series, and you know, in spite of the fact that he was club captain. Did he get blowback from the fans for featuring in the first series that maybe made him be reticent to do it again?
For what it's worth, Anthony, George Honeyman has never been someone who has firmly had all the faith of the entire fan base. He's always polarised. A lot of people in the fan base have a lot of time for him. They think he was a hard-working footballer, you know, who did have talent that, you know, he frequently displayed on the pitch. He could chip in with a goal. Mm-hmm. You know, he could bring the ball from midfield and he could push up with it. He could be offensively oriented and he was strong in the tackle. I mean, I always liked him, but equally, there were a lot of members of the fan base who thought he offered nothing, who just thought he was taking up a space on the team and that we were giving him a bit of a free ride because he was a local lad and because he did endear himself to the fans. You know, not only on the documentary, but on the pitch in the championship season. So I think, you know, I mean, if I was George Honeyman personally, I'd be very aware of that. I'd be aware that maybe I'm not a firm favourite from the entire fan base. And obviously, if things do start to go wrong, then maybe I don't want this to perhaps tarnish my reputation, you know, unfairly. Because at the end of the day, he's always been a model professional. And I can't imagine that he would ever have done anything to jeopardise that by way of unprofessionalism.
Yeah, I saw actually that he came on your most recent pod, and I guess it was good to hear from him, despite obviously not being part of the playing squad any longer. He still sort of holds Sunderland very true to his heart, and that feels like quite a rare breed in today's football, where, you know, players don't really play for the club. That, you know, they've always got one eye on their future and going somewhere else. And he almost seemed quite emotional actually when he was talking about his time at Sunderland on your pod. So I did find it very interesting sort of when he was talking about the circumstances around his move to Hull and how the club hadn't actually offered him a new contract. His contract was running out. Hull were very interested, and you know, Sunderland just accepted the bid, and you know, he got a 4-year contract at Hull, championship side. So to him, it was almost like a no-brainer, despite kind of thinking at one point that he was going to be at Sunderland until, you know, the end of his career, essentially be a one-man club. So I don't know what you thought about that, because obviously it's similar to the Josh Madger situation, as in the club just let him go and didn't really try and fight for him at all. And I guess if he was the club captain, it's a strange circumstance.
Very much so, yeah. When Honeyman left, I was quite annoyed. I felt like at the time, I mean, obviously, all has been revealed since we had George Honeyman on the podcast that we just released today. And as it transpires, he left for $400,000 to Hull, seemingly from the first offer, just accepted like that. You know, it was annoying because obviously he's our captain and he had played a prominent role in the season before, and he still had a lot of fans within the club who were firmly behind him. So there was a feeling that perhaps he went for a rather meagre sum and he went rather easily, which didn't sit right with a lot of people. But I think as it has turned out, a lot of the assets that Sunderland have in the side are being sold off, and they're being sold off to the contradiction of many things, again, that Donald and Methven have said, you know, which is, I think, fairly indicative of everything else.
That's an issue that you guys touch upon in your podcast, where it was Jim Rodwell had just been appointed as CEO pod, for lack of a better term. And you were talking about how the big issue that the club needs to fix maybe now-ish, you know, post-Methven, let's say, is that the lack of the link between the dugout and the boardroom. And that's really interesting to hear that, like, you're kind of giving up your younger talent, but maybe is that just another symptom of a greater problem?
Yeah, obviously, I think you're right. I think the problem that we're faced with now, and I'm sure we'll come to this a lot later, is that a lot of the failings of last season are now going to become a problem this season. any club being in League One for an extended period of time is not going to reap the financial rewards of a club in, say, the Championship or the Premier League. And as a consequence of that, as a consequence of Donald and Methven and Madrox or whoever you want to refer to as the powers that be not having the liquid assets themselves, what we are now going to see is the club potentially having to sell a lot of things that we would hope would add us a string to our bow going forward in the future. And counterproductive though that may be to our ambitions, it may be something that we're faced with as an unavoidable problem based on the failings of the previous year and indeed the failings of many, many years before.
Yeah, because it's not like Sunderland have been bringing in this great scientific approach to transfers or scouting or where they source their players. Like even the fact that they were aiming to pick up two strikers in the January transfer window where they ended up just blowing their whole budget and some more on Greig, it kind of indicates that on a football side of things, the club is really struggling in just the administrative sense.
Yes, absolutely, I would say so. I think you've just got to look at the infrastructure, or at least what you were told about the infrastructure from, say, the documentary or just any sort of literature or media sources lurking in the background. It doesn't, I don't think, take a particularly trained eye to see that the infrastructure at the club is not only very basic, but I think very, very amateur for the level that we're at. As of the 18-19 season, we had one sort of out-and-out scout on the books in Tony Courton. You had Donald and Methven effectively at the wheel at the most part for the day-to-day administration. And I think if I'd have seen Eastleigh run like this, I would think, yeah, that's an acceptable way to run a club of this stature. But for Sunderland, and again, I don't want to be the fan who believes he has a God-given right to be in the Premier League just because we were there 4 years ago, I just think that the particular infrastructure that they have taken with them from Eastleigh to Sunderland is one that is going to see us come up short in a lot of financial sort of dealings with other clubs. I mean, you saw there with Wigan, they absolutely had us on toast with Will Grigg. You know, they knew full well that we were on our knees looking for a striker. They knew that we had failed to replace Madger and had retrospectively made a very poor decision in selling him in the first place. If they wanted to drive a ridiculous bargain for him, then they were going to do that. And while it's great to see that Donald cared enough to invest so much of the club's finances in getting a striker, really, you know, that kind of cavalier bravery doesn't pay off when the striker doesn't return the goals that is some warranted. And obviously the consequences now is that we've gone 3 million in the hole for a striker that so far we're yet to see 10 goals from in all competitions.
Yeah, despite what he said about him scoring 10 goals in 16 games, I think he set himself as being his target while in the Premier in Sunderland, yeah. I assume. So I think that kind of nicely bridges actually to the kind of the big exam question of Sunderland till I die, which we kind of touched on last week. But with you on, obviously, we want to get that kind of more rounded view. Who's to blame for that failed campaign? Obviously, you could apportion blame out to lots of people, but if you were to say, all right, this person's definitely to blame, who would that be? Would it be Methven? Would it be Jack Ross? Would it be Stuart Donald for spaffing that £3 million and being had on toast, as you said, by Wigan? Like, so I think the three of us broadly were saying, well, that probably undermines Jack Ross. And that decision is basically what everything really came from in terms of how the season unraveled.
While towards the end of his tenure at the club, the results weren't going well and his style of football ultimately wasn't working, I think Jack Ross had a hell of a task. At the end of the day, he may have taken over a club that had new investment that had allegedly, of course, paid off all of its debts and was now squeaky clean for whoever's going to take it forward. He still had a hell of a task on his hands. You know, all of the first team players that were there at the terminus of the Championship season, a lot of them had very poor attitudes and a lot of them wanted to leave, and that left him with very few to work with. He then, with the help of one scout, had to bring in an entirely new team, and with that entire new team was expected to win League One. You know, the Sunderland fans, their only recollection of the third tier, those who have them, was the 87-88 season when they were relegated under Laurie McMenemy and went straight back up. And I think because that is the legacy of Sunderland in the third division, it sets something of a precedent for the fans to think, right, well, if we go down there again, we've got to go straight back up. And obviously, again, there's no divine right for that to happen. So Jack Ross, yeah, he had a very difficult task, and I certainly wouldn't blame him. I think, like I say, I did allude to who I would sort of pin the blame at, really, for the failings overall. And I think I would blame Tony Courton and then, by extension, Stuart Donald for the administrative decisions and decisions for how his infrastructure was going to look. I think, obviously, with Courton, he made a few signings that proved to be costly in the long run, that proved to leave fundamental weaknesses in our team. He was effectively tasked with restructuring the club and introducing a style, you know, like a crop of players that would fit seamlessly into Jack Ross' style of play, ultimately ensuring promotion. That was always going to be hard. But we had players like Jack Baldwin and Tom Flanagan, who initially the fans were quite happy with, but then you saw games like the 5-4 against Coventry. And if it looked bad on the dock, then, you know, I was there. I remember watching them. I think he's called Brighton Ibukari, who was at Coventry on loan from Wolves. Yeah. And this lad, Jordi Huula, and they absolutely tore through them. There was a serious issue with a lack of steel and a lack of sort of strength in at the back. We signed Glenn Louvins, I remember, from Sheffield Wednesday, and that, quite frankly, just didn't work. He was clearly past it, far too slow, far too mal-coordinated. Ali Mozturk was a headless chicken and was dropped almost straight away. That left Baldwin and Flanagan, who were decent enough, I think, footballers. Technically, they were, you know, Baldwin was quite good. Flanagan could do the no-nonsense duties, but they lacked confidence. And when games went against them, they really went to pieces. And the Coventry game was the epitome of that, really. It just totally took them to bits. But yeah, ultimately, though, like I say, with Courton, it was still a very difficult task. And while I think he got a lot of decisions wrong, I would have to blame Stuart Donald ultimately, because while Courton was a one-man band, you know, it was Stuart who booked the one-man band, and it was Stuart who made a lot of sort of decisions in the framework. You know, I don't think he did them with anything that wasn't the best intentions, but I think his experience of his experience of owning a club at that level, you know, it shone through.
Oh, interesting. Well, you'd have thought with Tony Cotton's playing history, he'd be a safe pair of hands, but unfortunately it's not quite worked out there. No, interesting. The Donald decision, I think when we were watching the doc and we were watching him kind of going through that decision process to make the Grigg purchase, it was really incredible, wasn't it, that he was being advised all around by Jack Ross, even by, you know, the two flunkies, is it Fox and Richards, to say, oh, you know, this isn't worth it, mate, this isn't worth it. And yeah, him ultimately pushing that through, at the behest of, you know, no one except himself, just seemed very odd and seemed very kind of naive almost.
Yeah, well, have you seen that David Squires comic where it's got like Donald and he's saying, right, well, okay, 3 million, we'll not back out now, and then he goes, yeah, well, we already own him, those two, right, 8 million, no one takes us for mugs. That's sort of how it feels as a fan, I think, when I look back and I'm thinking, right, everyone around him is saying, Stuart, don't do it, you know, 3 million, this is insanity, Stuart, we don't have those funds. He's like, no, we do have the funds, no, but we're gonna buy him. And again, like I say, there's a certain cavalier sort of spirit there, certain, like, you know, bold yet sort of blind bravery that's on display. And it's very noble. And it certainly endears me to Stuart Donald as someone who cares about the club, especially considering that the previous owner was one who refused to invest whatsoever towards the end of his time at the club. So we've gone really from one extreme to the other. Really, there was an absent chairman to one who cares so much that he's prepared to put all of his eggs in one basket.
It was quite interesting, though, with that deadline day decision to buy Will Grigg. But I think I heard on your podcast that you said about how Stuart has kind of made loads of promises on Twitter, and he was doing all the rounds saying he was definitely going to buy a striker, and everyone was sort of talking about, oh, yeah, he's definitely going to bring one in. And then obviously got to deadline day, so he kind of hamstrung himself a little bit, because if he didn't bring in a forward at this stage, then, you know, he'd have broken all his promises that he'd promised to all the various fans on Twitter and on the podcast, etc. And I heard that, yeah, he doesn't really make those appearances now. It's almost like the door is firmly shut. No one can, he's not really doing the same level of comms as he was when he first joined, first bought the club. And do you think that's based on the back of this decision and sort of having learnt his lesson to it?
I think it's based on the culmination of many decisions, to be honest, Nick. I was at a talk-in in a place called Town End, which is in Sunderland, about 4 or 5 months ago now. And that was hosted by Charlie Methven. And the first thing he said before any questions were asked was that, I'm just going to tell everyone here now that you won't be hearing again from Stuart Donald because of simply all of the sort of negativity he's had on social media. What has effectively happened with Stuart Donald is that while he was on Twitter in the early days, it seemed like a great thing. You know, I mean, we've got an owner who cares so much about connecting with the fans that he is literally connecting with us on social media, which is absolutely brilliant. But I think a fear that we all had at the time is that if this turns sour, what is it going to be like having the owner on Twitter if, let's say, we're losing lots of games, or let's say we end up losing a player who was highly valued, etc., etc.? As it turns out, all of those fears were realised, because when things did turn a bit ugly, the fans turned on Donald, and the fans turned on Donald on social media. They weren't happy with him. They were telling him, you know, this isn't on. You're replying to him saying, look, you know, you need to sort this out. Perhaps he did make a rod for his own back in that sense, because he did at the same time, Nick, say a lot of things that he effectively bound himself to saying, you know, saying that he wanted to get a striker. Ultimately, he did bring in another striker that wasn't Will Griggy, this lad called Keziah Sterling from Tottenham on loan, which I don't think really made the documentary at all, purely because it wasn't very interesting. But obviously, if that was the only signing on deadline day, the fans would not have been happy, and we would have seen a lot of flack aimed at Donald a lot earlier than when it did. So the fact that he needed to get Grigg in was, as you say there, perhaps driven by a desperation to deliver on his promises, which again is a great example of nobility on his part. But it's something he didn't need to do to himself. It's one of many occasions on social media where I think he shot himself in the foot by being too open with fans.
One person who's a big part of the show, but absent maybe from any of this blame discussion that we've had, is Charlie Methven. Mm-hmm. And I guess in the documentary, we see how he deals with staffing and maybe bringing change to the non-football side of the club in particular, causing quite a lot of friction and trouble. And the fans seem to have questions, but maybe seem to be taking it in. What do you think he could be blamed for?
Because he doesn't have as big of an administrative sway in the literal sense over the club. You know, he doesn't call as many shots as Donald does, you know, just by virtue of rank within the club. He's acted more as either sort of had a very hands-on role with the marketing and the comms and the PR for the club. But otherwise, he would act as Donald's advisor. And I think he would echo a lot of sentiments that Donald said, which would turn out ultimately to not be true. He, like Donald, said a lot of things that, as it transpires, don't seem to be the case for the fans. And interestingly as well, and perhaps ironically, there have also been many occasions where Methven has said one thing and Donald has said another, you know, only to confuse the fans. There have been a lot of talk shows and podcasts, for example. I think the first Roker Report podcast with the owners before the start of the 1920 season, we were effectively, and Methven since has backtracked these comments. He did so at the very talk, and I was referring to at Townend. He said that we were going for what was effectively an 100-point season. That was something of an ambition. And obviously to say that is a very, very big statement. And again, is one of those statements that you've made that you're effectively binding yourself by. But really, who you're binding isn't so much yourself. It's more so Jack Ross. You know, if you say on the podcast, right, 100-point season, that's the aim, you know, the manager is then expected to aim for 100 points. So obviously to say that he's going to potentially be getting 100 points, you know, I think that's quite a daunting prospect for any manager. You know, again, I say it as respectfully as I can. I just think that a lot of the decisions that he's made, you know, could have perhaps been avoided, or perhaps display the same inexperience that Donald had going from Eastleigh to Sunderland, where he's been very eager to set a lot of things in place. But in that eagerness, perhaps naivety is being born from it.
Oh, well, yeah, sounds like I guess we were aligned in some ways in terms of how you saw the season. But for some other aspects, as I'm sure you listeners will have heard, there's definitely value in having that insight from somebody who's on the ground at the coalface rather than us being distant in our near earth orbit of a pod. Right, we'll take a break there and we'll move on to the epilogue. What happened next after this?
Who got the assist?
So we're back and it's the second half and it's the epilogue. What happened next? So many interesting individuals, and obviously we started touching upon them, started speaking about them. And I guess the first half was about talking about the series, and this half is more about talking about individuals and kind of what's happened since the series. Because for a lot of us, unless you've been a big fan of Sunderland or have been following them closely, you may not know what happened next. The first thing though, How has 2019-20 treated Sunderland, Alex? How are you guys doing? I don't think you're going to get up, are you, or into the playoffs at least, if the season's cancelled?
No. I mean, obviously, 19-20 has treated every club the same towards its end, in that no one's playing football because of the pandemic, of course. But talking purely from on a football standpoint, yeah, the 19-20 season's been rather disappointing for Sunderland. In terms of the standard that we've seen, it's certainly not been as good as the season before, which all the fans will tell you, you know, had its glaring weaknesses as well. We haven't drawn as many games, but the consequence is that instead of winning the games we would have drawn, we've lost them instead. Jack Ross got the season off to a fairly decent start at first, and looked like he was going to have a similar season to the one before, hopefully with a promotion instead of, you know, narrowly missing out on one. But I think he got to perhaps, I remember it was the Bolton game, it was around, I think, October time. Yeah, I think it was around October. I might be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure it was about mid-October. We played Bolton away, and I think that was the Bolton team who only had 9 senior players on the books. And I remember we drew that game 1-1, and we were really lucky to even get anything from that game. I remember thinking, you know, this is shocking. You know, I genuinely feel quite bad for the Bolton fans here, because they deserve to win this about 3-0. You know, they've totally and utterly outplayed us, and we've looked completely abject. Jack Ross played a lot of negative football, and a lot of it was seen in games like that. And that bad form from then, he never really picked back up on it. There was, I think, one more win since that, and then there came a really bad loss to Lincoln when they lost 2-0 away. And again, it was really defensive, really negative. The players didn't quite look like they knew what the system was supposed to sort of entail. And consequently, he lost his job, was replaced by Phil Parkinson, who would have something like a 14-game run without a win. Somehow didn't get sacked himself, then had a better run, and now we're here, really. We had a better run, and then in the last 2 games, we dropped back off again. The conventional table has us now sitting 7th, but according to the proposed points per game unweighted table that the EFL are potentially going to use to determine the leagues, Sunderland will finish the season 8th. Which will break last season's record of the lowest ever finish in a league in the club's history.
That points per game table may actually feed towards meaning that the league one season will be tried to play out. I'm looking at it here, and in terms of, like, there's 1 point separating 8th and 3rd.
Yeah. This season, that's been one thing that benefited Sunderland, is that nobody has really had the bottle to go ahead and win and try and win the title at this point. Luton and Barnsley were starting their breakaway, I think, around this time last season. But Coventry have started garnering some momentum. But you look at teams like Rotherham, Oxford, Wickham, Portsmouth, Peterborough, Sunderland. You know, they're all sort of taking turns threatening to be a team that could get in the automatics and then fall away again. I think it'll be quite hard if the clubs of League One have to vote on where they're going to be. Sunderland, like many others, they're going to have a hard time reaching a unanimous decision, because there are loads of different horses in this race, and a lot of different decisions are going to benefit some and severely hinder others.
Yeah, it all seems very tight at the top at the moment. Going back to Jack Ross, I heard on your podcast with George Honeyman that he was surprised that Jack Ross was let go, and he really loved working with him. And that seems to be the vibe that we got from many of the players. I think the likes of Aidan McGeady also thrived under Jack Ross. Were you kind of surprised by the sacking then? We kind of saw on the podcast the likes of Charlie Methven were quite critical of him, and Stuart obviously seemed quite critical when he was on your podcast as well.
At the time, I wasn't particularly surprised by the sacking, no. Given how the results had been going and how the performances had been, Jack Ross looked like a manager on the verge of losing his job. A lot of the mistakes that we'd seen last season were being emulated, and there were a lot of new problems as well. I think, like I said there, he'd adapted a system in pre-season, and he simply hadn't used the pre-season to his advantage at all. He tried out this 5-3-2 in a few friendly games, and it didn't work. And then about 3 games in, he dropped it for a more sort of mundane 4-4-2. But a lot of players were sort of chopping and changing in a lot of different fundamental roles. And I think as a problem arising from that, we didn't really look like we had a clear identity. A lot of the times players looked like they were just kind of winging it. And I think we're getting by a few games just by individual quality. You know, your players like your Aidan McGeady, who every now and then had to win you the game by just sort of nicking a goal from 20 yards out that a lot of players in League One can't score. And that was making the difference. I think for Jack Ross to ultimately be found out as a manager who was ultimately found wanting tactically in a few places, despite his best efforts and intentions, it wasn't a surprise. And I think most of the fan base would probably agree with me at the time. It was certainly no surprise that Jack Ross was going to get sacked.
Yeah, it was interesting with Aidan McGeady, who we just talked about. So he, as I said, he seemed to do quite well under Jack Ross. But since Phil Parkinson took over, there was rumours of an alleged bust up with him, that he was a disruptive influence. And ultimately, he was then sent packing on loan, which seemed a bit surprising considering he was your kind of star man, at least in what we saw in the documentary and the start of last season as well.
Mm. McGeady dropped away seemingly out of nowhere when Parkinson came in. And like you've said there, that there were rumours that we've heard. Nothing, I don't think we can really confirm because we're none the wiser as well. But the implication was that there was something of a fallout between himself and Parkinson. And as a result, McGeady ended up not playing. And it isn't the first time that we've heard this from Aidan McGeady. Obviously, he was signed back in 2017 by Simon Grayson, who he worked with at Preston and clearly had a lot of time and a lot of respect for, because he featured under Grayson prominently and he played a lot. And he had a lot of good performances under Simon Grayson. Chris Coleman then came in, and similar to the Ross-Parkinson shift, he seemed to fall out of favour quite quickly. So maybe if you look at it quite empirically, if you look at the evidence, there's reason to suggest that maybe McGeady has, you know, he likes to work for some managers and not others, or just perhaps some managers play him the way he can be utilised best and he believes he's utilised best. And if perhaps he isn't and he's to play a role that he doesn't like or doesn't want, then maybe he does tend to fall out with his managers. Really, I don't know enough about McGeady as a professional and as a person to make any sort of sweeping statements, because I think he played maybe one or two games under Parkinson and then all of a sudden he was consigned to the bench, never to emerge from it, in a lot of games where we played quite abject defensive performances as well. The shift in what Parkinson wants to do doesn't involve someone with, you know, the rather rogue creativity of McGeady.
And I guess one player moving on from McGeady to perhaps the player that should have been a star but wasn't, and now has the goal record of a centre-back. So 20 appearances, one goal, one assist, according to Transfer Market this season for good old Will Grigg. Not on fire.
Anything but Will Grigg. At this time last season, Lee Cattermole had about 6 goals. So that tells you all you need to know about how clinical he's been. But to be honest, though, I think with Will Grigg, a lot of his problems happened early on, because he came to Sunderland with a real expectation, and I think that did weigh around his neck. I've got a lot of time for our fan base. I think that the Sunderland fan base is a brilliant one, but it is a fan base that mounts a lot of expectations on its players. You know, and if the player comes with pedigree, that's amplified tenfold. And obviously in League One, you know, Will Grigg is your star man. If you were to take the two top leagues out of English football and League One's your new Premier League, then Will Grigg's suddenly one of the best strikers in the country, because that's the reputation he has at that level. Yep. And the fans knew that, and the fans were expecting him to come in and replace Madger and potentially Betteren, which was going to always take some doing because Madger was brilliant. Mm-hmm. The problem was that in the early games, Will Grigg was brought out when he was signed and he was sort of paraded around the pitch in his first game. You know, all the fans were waving at him. You know, everyone was lining up to try and interview him. One of the first things we heard him say as a Sunderland player was, "I really wasn't expecting, you know, a reception like this." And I think that tells you all you need to know about how it went for him. His first game that he started at home, there was a great chance which made the documentary where he runs one-on-one. He's beating the keeper. Braced he's got us. An empty net on the left-hand side and he hits the side netting. And it's moments like those that really just sort of, well, as a Sunderland fan, thinking, oh, there's going to be one of those signings where, you know, it's shattered from the high heavens how great he is and he's just not going to do it. And I think because of the expectations, I think that did get to him a bit. And it hasn't fell for him. I think if a couple of earlier chances had fallen for him and gone the right way, then he could have perhaps have made a name for himself. He could have perhaps lived up to the expectations of the fans. In a lot of ways, it's a lot of how I saw when we signed Josie out the door a few years ago. But that's, again, a whole different story.
Oh, what a hero he was, dear me. He smashed it in the Dutch league. Oh, absolutely, Josie. An absolute donkey for you guys, it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, interesting. I've heard from the guys that he's been benched a lot, Will Grigg. seems to need that bit of luck. They made the comparison with Duncan Watmore and what happened when he was just thrown in, brought back from loan, I believe, and thrown into the squad. And maybe that might happen. Maybe with Wahlgren, there was a touch of him talking himself up too much as well. He kept saying, oh, I seem to thrive on big occasions. And yeah, I'm definitely, as I mentioned earlier, going to get 10 goals. Mm-hmm. Oh dear, yeah, putting too much pressure on himself. Another guy I think of, it's worth moving on to Luke 09, the guy who we referred to several times as being a bit of a Disney prince. Just he seems so likable, seems so friendly, seems so unassuming, doesn't he? And the guys on the pod mentioned that he went from kind of a centre midfield sort of slot to being a right back or something like that, and he's been kind of completely reborn.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Luke 09, he was brought into Sunderland and with the view that he's going to be like a midfielder and potentially like a cam, you know, very much an attacking mid. I think when he played at Wickham, he more often than not linked up play between the midfield and Big Akin Fenway up front. So I think a lot of the fans were expecting him to play a similar role at Sunderland. But when he first had started, and he admitted as much himself, he was very keen to get himself about, and he was just sort of running everywhere. Like that. That's what he was doing. Like when he was first, because he didn't start initially, because he wasn't in the sort of starting 11 that was winning games early on. But when he was brought on off the bench, he did just seem to run at everything. He'd lose the ball and he'd run after it, and then the man would tackle him, then he'd run after the man, and then the ball would go out, and he'd run after the ball. It's like if you put like a Jack Russell's brain in a human's body, that's kind of what it felt like watching Luke in my early doors. And you know, again, I mean that in the most endearing way, because he really did try. But ultimately, he admitted himself, you know, he was just trying too hard. And ultimately, once he'd settled down and once he'd been sort of relocated to right back, initially, you know, as a makeshift position, but he really did establish himself in that role. And Luke going on a right back ever since, for me, has been a really solid part of that team. You know, he makes a lot of good runs forward. He's strong in the tackle. He plays very conventionally as a wing back, and he does it very well. One thing that Jack Ross did try and do, and one thing that Parkinson plays to as well, is a lot of actions from the wing, a lot of sort of wingers getting forward, the fullback overlapping. We'll have Human Gooch on one side doing that, and then normally Luke O'Nine and another winger on the other. And for all intents and purposes, it's worked effectively, and it's worked to Luke O'Nine's most prominent attributes. So I think once he himself was able to settle and he himself was able to realise, right, I've got my role, I've got my strengths, and I can use them to their best advantage here, it worked for him.
Yeah, something we seized upon when we were watching the doc was the shrine that Luke O'Nine, there was a shrine to Luke O'Nine in one of the fans' houses. I'm not sure if you saw that in the episode. You haven't installed one of those, have you? But I guess it's...
I haven't, no.
It speaks to how good he is, though, outside of the club in terms of with fans, etc. He seems to really get involved with that.
Yeah, and I'm basing it just on what I've seen, which is as much as what everyone else has seen watching the documentary, but he's just got no... He seems to have just no ego about him, like a really just humble, down-to-earth, grounded professional figure. It's an example that sounds a bit like a joke, but honestly, it's another the first or second episode when Luke O'Nine's helping out with the changing of the seats with the fans, and then one of the fans goes, yeah, you can get this photo one, do you, when you're famous, son? And like, you know, it's obviously, it's seen as a joke, but like, look, but he just laughs it off. You know, you can see from his expression that he just finds that funny. You know, like he doesn't ever feel like threatened based on his sort of stature as a footballer. In an age where perhaps a lot of footballers would be like that. I mean, this is the same Sunderland who 3 years ago at the time would have Adnan Januzaj at the club. He'd upload training photos to his Instagram and he'd edit off the Sunderland badge. And, you know, you'd look at that and you just think, you absolute, you know, you know, that's just, I mean, obviously you're dropping quality quite significantly from the Premier League to League One, but what you're gaining, thankfully, are players who, you know, have a bit more of a grip on reality, which Luke O'Nine most certainly does.
No, that's cool. I think to round off this play a bit, Jack Baldwin, I think, is probably a guy worth mentioning because he, at the beginning, he and his kind of family were used as a way of kind of illustrating that difference between a Premier League player and a player and kind of a journeyman in League One. And obviously, kind of towards the end of the season, the Flanagan-Baldwin axis in the centre of defence just hasn't worked, and Baldwin's the one who takes the hit. I mean, I think he's left now, hasn't he? I think he's gone to Salford or something like that. And you guys in the pod mentioned that he kind of lacks that kind of bit of star quality that I guess you need to kind of be a Sunderland player. I mean, was how he came across in the show similar to how he played?
Yeah, I think so. In his first few games that we saw from Baldwin, he looked like a really astute signing. His defensive displays were really solid. He seemed to really take to the environment. You know, initially we could say nothing but good about Jack Baldwin, but unfortunately, as the seasons went on, a lot of mistakes were made, and I think certainly an element of his character was exposed in that the confidence was drained from him, as it so often can be, I think, from players when they play in an environment like the Stadium of Light. We've interviewed quite a lot of players for the site, and one thing that they always say without doubt is that Sunderland is the best and the worst team to play for as a player, because when things are going well, you're untouchable, and when things are going badly, you know, the environment can just be brutal to have to play your football in. And I would imagine for Baldwin, when the going got tough, that became quite a burden to take on his shoulders. And with absolutely no disrespect to the clubs he played for prior, which off the top of my head I know are Hartlepool and Peterborough, those are clubs which generally don't command as much of a following, especially at home, as Sunderland. And I would imagine that, you know, with the weight of expectations, especially considering that season, how many sort of high-caliber, high-profile games were played, you know, two at Wembley, you know, there was a playoff run, there were loads of sort of like promotion six-pointers along the way. I could imagine that a lot of that would get to you. And certainly, I wouldn't blame him at all if he really felt the pressure from that. And, you know, in an age where obviously mental health is very important, I think a lot of consideration has to be given to players who obviously are certainly feeling the heat with such a sudden jump in the intensity and the raw dedication of a fan base, to let the players know exactly how they feel at that time, which rightly or wrongly Sunderland fans most certainly do.
Yeah, you do see that a little bit with Baldwin and Flanagan, don't you, in the documentary, and just how they're kind of not really cut out for, you know, playing for such a big club like Sunderland. But moving on to the ownership and just how, I guess, they're portrayed in the documentary as well, starting with Stuart Donald. I guess he's quite interesting because obviously, you know, we do kind of, when we discussed it, we did kind of blame him, saw him as the ultimate responsibility for their failings in the league. But he also comes across quite a sympathetic character at points during the show, wouldn't you agree? I mean, you can see to a certain extent he does sort of wear his heart on his sleeve, and, you know, he really appears to care about the club. And you see that, especially when they sort of go off to Portsmouth for the away match in the playoff semi-final.
Yeah, no. I think when you look at how Donald himself has been invested in the club, not invested financially, invested emotionally in the club. Certainly, he's been with the fans the whole way. Every decision that he's made has clearly weighed very heavily on him, and every high and every low is very clearly felt by him. He's, you know, I think the cynics among the Sunderland fans, entitled though they are, they're a pigeon, will say, you know, Donald. Just a wide boy, you know, he only came to turn a quick profit, you know, he doesn't have any investment in Sunderland, he doesn't really care, he just wants to, you know, get the club up somewhere and then flip it for some cash and, you know, walk away with more money than he walked in with. And, you know, I'm fully of the belief that Donald intends to sell the club for more than what he bought it for, because that's purely, you know, if he wants to make a good financial decision, that would be a good financial decision. But to say that Donald doesn't care about the success of Sunderland Football Club purely because it's great to watch a club like Sunderland succeed, I think would be a lie. I think certainly Donald did care massively, and you can see that in the documentary. I don't think that he was asked to play anything up to the camera. I think when he sat there head in hands trying to get the Will Grigg deal over the line, that is genuine angst, that is genuine anxiety, and that is a man desperate to get a signing that will ensure the football club he owns is one that can compete for the title of the division it's in.
No, very interesting. And I guess if we spoke about Charlie earlier on, just move on to him. And I guess Craig and Gav were kind of, and I think you kind of expressed this a little bit as well, they were kind of grudgingly accepting of him a little bit. You know, they called him kind of the centrepiece of the whole series, and he came across as kind of very well intentioned. I think the guy said that they admired his ferocity. He has left the club now and left the board. Like, now he's gone, do you kind of see some sympathy for him, or do you think that it's a good kind of exit, especially with, and we'll move on to it in just a second, but probably a nice bridge to mention, Jim Rodwell is all here. Popular appointment, you guys called him a screaming disaster. And he's also called Rodwell as well, which is a nominative determinism.
Jay Rodwell in the club.
Jay Rodwell's back. And now he's got more control over the club's finances than he did before. But yeah, no, we'll get to him. But yeah, Charlie Methven's departure came at the right time. I think it was best for both himself and for the club that he left when he did. I think when you look at what Charlie Methven did in season two of Sunderland Till I Die, you know, the 18-19 season, obviously he took a very hands-on approach with them, the marketing, the comms and the PR. And while a lot of decisions, like I flagged up earlier, a lot of things that he'd said had either clashed with what Stuart had said or had turned out to be the contradiction of what we're seeing right now, ultimately, I think Charlie Methven, again, much like Donald, was making a lot of decisions with the intention of Sunderland succeeding because they wanted Sunderland to succeed. When you listen to what he says about the business model that Martin Bain and Ellis Short left behind, you know, he's absolutely bang on the money. For all of Martin Bain's talk in season one about how, you know, he'd sit there sort of in like his chair, slightly reclined, facing just away from the camera, light on his face, watch in full view, you know, with a sort of like winning smile, but sort of like that look of saying, look at me, I'm really trying here, I'm the main character. I'm this really swell guy. Please listen to Mr. Accountant over here. You know, that's sort of the impression you got from Martin Bain. But then obviously Methven comes out in season two and says, look, the model that we used to have here was, you know, was a failed something upped model. He was bang on the money. The philosophy at Sunderland before Donald and Methven was that if something isn't working or if you don't want to pivot something, just hand the check to the Floridian billionaire, you know, thousands of miles away, and he'll pay it off for you. Don't worry about money. That's not an object. So obviously the club can't operate like that or sustain itself. And, you know, Methven was right that we needed to stop the club hemorrhaging money, and a lot of shrewd financial decisions had to be made on the marketing front, on the commercial front, to ensure that the club was more sustainable. If you look at how we did on the Boxing Day game at Bradford, I thought that was actually fairly inspired, because the way that was marketed ultimately ensured that we got an absolutely bumper crowd. There was that great moment where he's talking to Oscar Chamberlain, who's in charge of the media, and he says, oh, well, look, it's the previous record attendance in the League One was Leeds. So obviously Bradford are coming. You know, why don't we play to that? Why don't we try and knock Leeds off that pedestal? And obviously that played really well. I was at the game and it went over the tannoy that we'd beaten Leeds, and you heard that the Bradford fans were going mental at that, even though they were losing, they were in really good spirits, and ultimately that was a really good day out. And it's things like that that worked very well. The issue with Methven, how I see it, is that the very same documentary that highlights things that he got very right, unfortunately there were a lot of like ad hominem things that he did that he'll be remembered, you know, quite wrongly for the things that he didn't get right. Despite obviously being the sort of PR guy, there were things that he was doing, things that he did, that a lot of people will, you know, think of him negatively of, or will ruin his reputation of in many eyes. You know, you start with the very David Brent-esque sort of scene in episode one where he's talking about the Balearic atmosphere in the stadium. He's sort of like, he's doing like his finger guns, walking up and down the stands, listening to Frankie test the audio. And then of course on the very same Boxing Day game, he's absolutely I forget the woman's name now, I did remember this, but he's like having a right go at her about the numbers. You know, he's like swearing effing and jeffing, saying, you know, like, I don't care about that, you've got to get me this now, you know. And he comes across as a very sort of like cutthroat taskmaster, which, you know, I'm sure isn't the image you would want for the documentary, but that's what he displays nonetheless. And that's unfortunately a lot of the mistakes that Methven made, is that a lot of the things that he said and a lot of things that he did not endear him to the fans. I think there was one part where there's one thing he said to the fan base. It was quite early on in Donald's tenure when it was emerging that a lot of the pubs in Sunderland were streaming the games, which meant that fans maybe possibly weren't going to the matches, they were watching the games in the pubs. And, you know, I can understand why you possibly wouldn't want that. You know, you're not going to make as much revenue if the pubs are streaming the games. But he openly said, you know, if you're doing this, then you're a parasite. And obviously, you know, I mean, I get that you want the fans to be in the stadium. That's going to generate money.
But, classic Charlie.
That's, you know, yeah, that's something you see in the League of Ireland over at home, is that, you know, the clubs hate being on the television because it means that the fans don't turn up, and that's the revenue is their lifeblood. But I don't even think I've heard them go for the parasite line. That's pretty...
No, yeah, and it's
very,
things
very
like...
strong term. Yeah,
yeah, it's strong things like that, really, that ultimately have tarnished a lot of the things that Charlie's done, because the way I see it is that a lot of decisions he's made have been ones that have been beneficial for the club. You know, like I said, the examples I mentioned, he did get quite a few things right, but a lot of ad hominem problems like those are what have ruined his reputation in the eyes of many Sunderland fans. And I think when he announced that he was going to step away from the board, I think a lot of fans weren't unhappy when he did so. Mm-hmm.
He did seem a very sort of divisive character, and certainly got a few people riled up, like Sophie Ashcroft, as you mentioned.
That's the name.
But I think ultimately, I mean, whilst we might not have liked him as a personally, as you said, he's not, doesn't seem the nicest guy, he did ultimately get results, and some of his successful projects, like the Boxing Day, he was basically the brains behind that, and a lot of his ideas in terms of cost cutting and saving money for the club. Example again being the cryo chamber, which was ultimately only there for Martin Bain's back, as we found out in the last year. So yeah. I feel like, you know, he did achieve his goals, and it was quite interesting actually. You know, in terms of the Will Grigg transfer, we didn't really see Charlie's true reaction to that, but I felt like it was almost in the face of everything that Charlie had been trying to prevent. You know, the piss take party spending. Mm-hmm. Stupid money that wasn't worth it, and just someone just paying the bill, and that was kind of in the face of what he was trying to achieve in terms of cutting costs. So that was quite interesting. It kind of links in a little bit with his departure and the financial situation for the club now as well, because obviously I didn't really know the circumstance around his departure, if it was like a fallout with Stuart or any of the other sort of Eastley lot, or what happened exactly, and with Jim Rodwell coming in and the sort of the situation with the club now, and the financial situation still being a problem. I don't really know what you think, if you know anything more than myself on this.
About Methven's departure, I'm afraid I'm none the wiser, no. There are a multitude of reasons possibly as to why he left. He could have perhaps have lost interest. It could have been as simple as that, or it could be perhaps that, you know, he had had disagreements with Stuart Donald. It really, it's up in the air, but whatever the reason is, it didn't have a very savoury tone to it, and I think there was the possibility that, you know, he left under maybe more adverse circumstances. But again, that's entirely speculation. There are many reasons why that could have happened, but I think what you said there as well, Nick. I think if ever there were a set of words to precede a very unfortunate event, it was the phrase "the piss taking party is over." Because quite clearly, the piss-taking party is not over, because it's been happening ever since.
And I guess that piss-take party that you say that's kind of still going on is, I guess, what you folks kind of view as a jobs for the boys type scenario that's going on, and maybe a lot of people who are maybe out of their depth as well, who are coming up from Eastley. There was definitely hints of tension between Methven and the Eastley gang. And then maybe latterly, the Eastley gang in and of themselves and the influence that they hold, and maybe are they almost, to go back to that word, parasitic within the club?
I think clearly there was something of a... The dynamic can't have been as strong as what we would hope it would be if Methven was to depart the sort of, you want to say, consortium that he had been a part of at Eastley, the Eastley gang. Obviously, to use that phrase is completely apt. Obviously, there was a breakdown in dynamic somewhere down that line. But yeah, and the phrase as well, jobs for the boys, in conjunction with the piss-taking party, is a sentiment that I think a lot of Sunderland fans will be feeling right now. And with Jim Rodwell, absolutely, that's what it feels like. We spoke to a lot of fans from clubs that formerly Rodwell had been a part of, and it had been nothing but bad news, really. I mean, he'd been at Scunthorpe, where they had nothing, you know, we interviewed a Scunthorpe fans and they had nothing good to say about him.
Yeah, you said he took Boston United from League Two to the Conference North.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah, that was the biggest red flag that I heard of all of them. for sure.
Yeah, that's a big yikes on that one. The we've seen a double relegation before. We don't need another one, and we certainly don't want to appoint someone who has overseen one. I mean, look, we said it on our editorial pod that we did when we appointed, I'm going to call him Jim because I don't like calling Rodwell. When we did that pod, I mean, I'll say it, as I said, anyone who comes to Sunderland, is that I will ultimately reserve judgment on the man as a Sunderland employee until he does something significant or until he's been here for an extended period of time to warrant judgment. But if we're expected to be optimistic or anything that isn't, you know, very cautious about this appointment, then, you know, people would be very disappointed because, you know, this is another one of Donald's affiliates, and now he's got a job at our club, and, you know, he's got a very poor pedigree, and it does just feel like, you know, where's the ambition here? You know, are we a club, you know, turning the oil tanker, or are we another free meal ticket for you know, mates of whoever's in charge of the club? Because that was where we were at under Martin Bain and Ellis Short, and that's ominously what it feels like round about now.
Definitely an element of history repeating itself, and definitely seems like Stuart's limitations have been more and more exposed. Like that the worst parts of the old-fashioned way, just leaning on a small cabal of people for information and leaning on a small cabal of people for advice and only listening to them. It was hinted at with the Grigg signing, and I think it's definitely, as you guys said in the editorial pod, come through now with the signing of Jim as the CEO. I remember I've seen that, and he said his football knowledge is second to none and he can only add value to his new employers at Sunderland AFC. You know, value to the Vanarama North. Hopefully not, but we'll see. And then the final thing, I guess, this week, the final thing to ask about is the financial situation. So I saw that there was a release by a lot of a furore just last week, actually, on this. And Kevin Maguire, the price of football, who I believe you spoke to actually as well. So he called all the numbers that they were saying. He called number one, didn't he? Because it was all just unbelievable pie in the sky sort of stuff. Like, so as I understand it, what they did was when they bought Sunderland, the parachute payments were given to Ellis Short, weren't they? And they said, okay, we're gonna basically pay those parachutes payments back over time. That was kind of how the deal was structured. And it just now looks like it's just, there's lots of money that's not accounted for, basically, and a lot of sophistries being used to explain where the money's gone. That's my understanding of it.
And an obligation was taken out of the whatever way it was structured, so that there was no longer an obligation on Stuart Donald to pay it back as well. Was a big issue, I think.
Yeah, so it all looks a bit dodgy, doesn't it? I mean, I can probably guess what the fan view is, but any insight you can provide us there would be great.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I leaned quite heavily on Maguire's The Price of Football to try and make sense of it myself, purely because it's like trying to sort of understand exactly how it's been structured is a bit like being led into a labyrinth. You know, you don't really know where you're going to come out of this and how well you're going to understand where you're going with it. But yeah, what you've said there, Tom, that your understanding of when Stuart Donald took over the club, again, to as much my knowledge as yours, that is how events transpired. The issue that we now seem to be facing, and again, this, and Maguire flagged this up on the podcast we did, is that, you know, he as he understands that the asking price for the club, you know, is a very high one, and that seems to be what is holding a lot of takeovers. I think is the exact phrase he used was that if you divide the sum by three, perhaps people will be talking. But ultimately, that seems to be a bit of a problem now, because the wonder is why the price is being driven up. It is, as far as I'm aware, to account for money that hasn't otherwise been accounted for. It would make sense, at least logically, if not rationally, that if a club like Sunderland is to be sold for, you know, a very ludicrous price, then the additional surplus would go towards paying off whatever hasn't been paid off yet. But then, if something hasn't been paid off yet, that brings us to the contradiction, which is perhaps the most damning of all that we've had so far as Sunderland fans, is that Methven has said that the club is debt-free. You know, again, not sort of like argue semantics, but if it's the case that there is money not being paid off, then the club is in debt-free. Not in practice, anyway.
Not how you would believe that or understand that when he says it to you, I suppose, is what you're getting
at. No, I wouldn't say so, no.
And it does sound like a lot of the trust has just gone now. And as you said, you've repeated that kind of cycle with Mandrox and Stuart Donald, as we've seen with the other ownerships in the past. I mean, and it's really, really interesting, like, just listening to rap to you and in terms of how Sunderland have gone, just because I think from watching the show and from kind of talking about it over the last few weeks, we've really all kind of got a bit kind of invested in your club, and it's very interesting to hear what's happened afterwards. And we all really wish Sunderland well, and I don't know about you guys, but I'll definitely be looking up your results when the football does return, just because I feel like for us and many other people at Stags, we are the target audience for Sunderland Side Eye, and I think you may see a whole kind of generation of people who have got a soft spot for you guys.
I really appreciate that, Tom. I mean, a little anecdote to finish off with, I went to San Francisco last year. And I was just in like a shop buying like I was just buying something from a corner shop, whatever they would call a corner shop, I suppose. And I remember, I think I was wearing like a Sunderland top, or just an old Sunderland top that I've got from like 2006. And the guy recognized it, like he recognized the badge as a Sunderland bag. And I said, oh yeah, yeah. He's like, he went to football soccer. He's like, oh, well, I mean, not really, but you know, I love the documentary. And it's just like, you know, obviously there is a football presence in America, but you just didn't expect it so remotely. And yeah, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of comments from loads of different people, like, you know, such as yourselves, about sort of wishing Sunderland well. And I think as a Sunderland fan, I really appreciate it, certainly.
They're definitely, you know, the team to pick if you're picking up Football Manager and want to, you know, go up the leagues pretty quickly in England anyway. You know, there's a kind of an interest there. There's good revenue to be brought in off the massive stadium. It's an interesting club to manage.
Yeah. Can you do what actual Sunderland can't do?
Of course.
Yeah, just promote Luke 09 to the Premier League. See if you can make that your ultimate goal.
Yeah, if I can make him like a monarch of a small country, I would do it in a heartbeat. Like, you know.
Yeah, he is for sure. Yeah, that was excellent. Thanks for joining us, Alex. That was really insightful in terms of a little bit more information than we garnered from the series in terms of what's happening with Sunderland and what's happened since. Just to say, we are Who Got the Assist. You can find us on Twitter at WGTN_FPL. At WGTA_Nick and at FPL Stag, and on Instagram at WGTA.FPL.
So yeah, thanks again, Alex, for coming on. It was absolutely brilliant to have you here and give us that insight. And you fielded an awful lot of questions and talked for an awful long time. So thank you so much.
A bit now, to be honest. That's as much talking as I'll do all week, honestly.
Yeah, you can have a silent retreat until Friday. So
yeah.
So Alex is, of course, the host of the Roker Rapport podcast, which, as Tom helpfully pointed out, is like the French word for good relationship. So you'll find him on Twitter at @AM_RokerRapport. And also then he is part of the Roker Report, which is the overall greater supporters content producers that you're part of. So thank you so much.
The mothership,
that's a great word for us. Yes, that's the Roker Report mothership. So yes, thanks so much, Alex. It's been brilliant.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Thanks very much for everyone who listened to this mini-series on Slide Eye. It's been a great fun to do. This might be it for a little while in terms of our pods, but it looks like FPL will be back before long. For the last time, we hope this assists you watch Sunderland Slide Eye. And stay safe, everybody. Speak to you very, very soon. Goodbye.
Slán.
Oh, it's a goal. Who got the assist?
Sports Social Podcast Network.